So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
This egg is going to hatch here tonight. As a matter of fact, hold on. This cracks me up. I can hear it starting to creak and crack right now. Everybody has speculated as to what might be in the egg. Is it a dinosaur? Is it a rabbit? Balloons? Is it the Playmate of the Month? Who knows? Well, the way it sounds to me right now, the speculating is all over. Oh, stand back.
Oh, look at the crunch.
I think that egg is ready to blow. Oh.
Oh, there it is. What is it?
What in the world?
I love
it. Oh, my God. What? What in the world is this? A little rooster tail up on top? I don't know. They got a pair of legs like my mother-in-law, pal. Look at the feet on this thing. I can't believe what in God's name is this. Holy. What? What is with the gobbledy? The gobbledygook. Ha! Don't tell me you're the gobbledygooker. You've got to be kidding me.
It's the Survivor Series.
Oh, before we start, I'll roll on this because I want your reaction. You have to listen to this. I promise this is worth your time. This... out of just randomly, November 20th of 1989.
The Warriors promo on the Heenan family.
Ultimate Warriors.
Bobby Heenan, Thanksgiving Day, this Thursday night, on Thanksgiving, people give. They give.
That's awesome.
Well, we've got something to give you. And let me tell you something, Bobby Heenan and your family, it's not going to be diced carrots. We're not going to give you a turkey. We're not going to give you sliced celery. We're going to get everything we've got, baby.
Sean's just pretending everything's okay.
Thanksgiving night, turkeys get scared, they run, and they lose their lives. And Heenan, your family's going to be no different.
He's just going to choke him.
I'll tell you what, the intensity of the Ultimate Warriors is all-time high. And this guy, Captain, has given us the intensity.
All-time high
family
would be accurate.
You're going to suffer the wrath of all the Ultimate Warriors. You travel as individuals, even though you call yourself.
That's amazing.
A family,
I love this.
You only live for yourself. I've come from the dark, deep past to bring these men together, and each one shall give me nothing.
Hey, guys, don't forget about me.
And family will pay the price and suffer.
He's
on a day
himself out.
That people give. We will only give.
Good night,
Art. Pain and destruction as I bring you the Ultimate Warrior.
Be a part of the Thanksgiving.
Oh, that was great.
And at the end of that, the producer said, that's a wrap. Great, guys. We got it.
Literally, that's a wrap.
Oh.
Well, you can definitely it wasn't scripted. You could say that.
What if it was? Would you be even more impressed?
I would.
Do you want to go through all my tabs, Wade?
I didn't dislike that. I thought that was great.
It was so fun.
Honestly.
Because it's so bland today.
Yes, exactly. Compare that to you know, your typical very rehearsed, pre-written promo, and I'll take that any day.
I also recommend this article on Viceway. How the hell did NFL Blitz ever get made? Did you ever play that game?
No, I did play NBA Jam, though.
The same creators.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah. Same guys.
This
like with Midway.
It was like the NFL version of NBA Jam. Yeah.
Well, and
I don't even know the rules of football, so why would I ever
No one knew that? The rules of football that played NFL Blitz.
Really?
I was so mad because a guy at school I lent that game to, and he never returned it to me.
What's the appeal? What do you mean? Like, how is it?
The NFL
they gave at Midway the license. Yeah. So you had the NFL license to make a video game.
Yeah.
And the guys were just goofing around, and they were pro wrestling fans.
Oh, yeah?
So they started inserting all these pro wrestling, like, pile drivers and leg drops, and they're just, like, hilariously, like, just fucking around.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then they were like, this is a fun game.
Yeah.
This should be the direction of this game. And they took it from, like, a traditional – not traditional, but it was going to be kind of in line with NBA Jam. So then when the NFL checked up on this, they were like – they watched the demo. They asked them to leave the room. And when they came back, they said, we cannot allow this to be a licensed game. And they had to work their ass off to keep the NFL on board, because that would be a major drop-off if you lost the license. And they were able to – they were able to compromise all this stuff. Like, okay, there cannot be any blood coming out of the players. They had problems with the idea that you could leg drop someone after the play, because that's against the rules. They had to ban spine busters because that's putting trauma on the neck. And it's like, part of me is like thinking, this is a stupid video game. Yeah. That it's like completely unrealistic violence.
And this is Midway who created Mortal Kombat.
Midway didn't have a problem with this. It was all the NFL. But apparently, one of the creators, they said, listen, one of the inspirations for this game was one of the NFL films that was just largely glorifying the history of violence in the league. It's like, let's not ignore the fact that the NFL largely sells violence, and we are just exploiting that.
Mm.
And the creation was NFL Blitz.
I could see why they, of course, from a peer standpoint, they'd have an issue with it. But, I mean, just from a gameplay standpoint, again, I played that WWE 2K16 game recently, and one of my complaints about it was just how slow it was. I mean, and I know they're trying to basically do a good job of simulating professional wrestling, but it was just – it wasn't a fun video game necessarily. And I know WWE released that, like – kind of like that arcade version of with like the jacked up wrestlers,
yes,
a couple years ago. I never played that. But I feel like, you know, again, I bring up like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater and how unrealistic that game was, but it was fun to play. I didn't want to play a realistic, you know, skateboarding game, just like how I loved NBA Jam.
Well, imagine UFC Blitz,
mm-hmm,
where the referee's trying to stop and you're just going, who's Samar Palharis? And you're just continuing to attack them. You guys fight out into the crowd.
Yeah.
You fight backstage. It's still guys in their shorts and their fighting attire, but it's no holds barred. And it's everything that mixed martial arts tries to shy away from. But it's just stupid fun in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
I've never understood the whole, oh, video games are to blame for this. No. What a stupid crutch to think that is somehow indicative of real life. This is fantasy.
Yes, yes. But I think a lot of people, I mean, parents, you know, I don't know. Maybe, I could see why the NFL would be concerned. If your job as a PR person for the NFL is to make sure that the brand identity is protected and that people, you know, like the WWE, that people don't make sure that your brand is not associated with violent, you know, head trauma, things like that.
Welcome to Review Away. This is how me and Way spend our days together, just talking about interesting situations and stories. How are you? How are you getting ready for American Thanksgiving next week?
By ignoring it.
Oh.
Largely. By being Canadian.
God, that's pretty, pretty awful.
Yeah, how are you preparing?
I just watched the Thanksgiving episode of The Sopranos from season 3.
And you actually watched it because of American
Thanksgiving? No, I'm just – that's where I'm up to in The Sopranos. That's okay. The show – that's the only show I'm watching currently.
Oh, cool.
It's a good show.
I've seen Sopranos. Bits and pieces. Yep. It's a little daunting to get into now at this point.
James Gandolfini is one of the best actors, I think, of the past 50 years.
Wow.
I saw him in this movie called The Last Castle in 2001. I thought he was excellent in that. But I never got into The Sopranos. I never watched it. I know that – was it Showcase or Bravo that had it here in Canada and had a censored version of it? And I just was like, that's kind of weird.
Hmm.
I didn't get into it. And now I'm watching all of them. And they just get better and better each season.
Cool.
Yep.
Nice.
It's about the
how's the
waste management industry in New Jersey.
Okay. Nice. I've heard the ending was kind of meh.
I'm not at the ending. I'm at season 3. Though I know how it ends. And amazingly way, that's not affecting my enjoyment of the show, even though I know how the show ends. Because in 2007, when the show ended, I heard about it. Even though I had plans to one day, years later, watch the show, I still had to hear the spoilers out there because it was a major event. And people talk about major events. Can we not talk about UFC 193 because people might not have watched the main event yet?
I think there's a grace period for certain things.
What's the grace period?
For the UFC? Well, again,
an hour?
It depends on the source, on the news source. If you're a news website, if your job is to cover the news, then it's immediately right afterwards.
I tweeted the result immediately.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with
that. So that's not a spoiler?
No, I don't think so. But, like, especially with DVR and you know, on demand for TV shows, I'd say, you know, maybe a solid week and a half. Just a spoiler.
A week and a half for a TV show?
For a TV show.
I guess so. TV's weird. It's like we play to me, the spoiler debate, it's on the user, not on the person that actually did watch the show. When I don't want to know something, I stay off.
Okay, what about a movie?
Outlets. A movie?
Yeah, in a theater.
You see, I don't see movie spoilers as too big of a thing.
I never see
spoilers for movies.
Okay. Well, like movie reviews, for instance.
I don't find movie reviews to be spoiling of anything. I mean, usually it's just an opinion of the movie, and they always dance around it because, I guess, to your point, they don't want to spoil anything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess movies are kind of a different area because you do have to physically go somewhere. There is a demand on your location. You have to go somewhere. You have to purchase it. TV, much more accessible. If you don't see it the minute it ends, you can easily find it online. It's all kind of self-contained.
But it's still about time.
Movies take more effort than shows to go see. Legally.
Okay, I don't know. It depends on the person.
Well, I was going to say something else, but I cannot recall. Something we have not done in some time, Way.
Yeah, what's that?
You have to get going?
No.
You seem like you're not interested in
this
discussion is
going. I am.
I've been following the show titles for Raw and SmackDown of late. I think we should do this once a month
We
look at theirs. Raw, over the past couple of weeks, of course, they peaked with Statue of Limitations, which is one that I will say I originated.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go on to some big ones, Way. The Accused, a show based, I guess, around Sting, leading into Night of Champions. Actually, Sting is in the photo of just about all of these here. One Man's Trash. The season premiere.
One Man's Trash, what is that?
That was when the statue got dumped into the garbage
truck.
The season premiere.
Yeah.
Demonic Duality. In Human Resources.
That
segment with the Human Resources woman. The Beast Takes Beantown. And Second City Demon. I don't think these people are sitting around for 20 minutes spitballing ideas, Way.
No.
However, on SmackDown, they have a few better ones. We've got The Queen City Lunatic, Fight in Philly, Angels and Demons. Let's go to the better ones.
These aren't any better.
Oh, wait. All in the Family for the Wyatts. Bubble Wrap Dudley when they had the bubble wrap table.
Bubble wrap.
Quiet Wyatt.
That's a good one.
And The Dolph Days of Summer.
Okay, those aren't bad. Those are pretty good.
Fight in Philly. Fight in Philly. So that's what we're missing out on, Way. I think our show titles, I think it's taken our creativity to a new level.
I like doing the show titles, though sometimes I wonder if it affects our YouTube views, like if people or even the webpage views, if people are less likely to click on it if they don't know what the show's about.
Yes, there is that.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just put the name of the title / John Cena, Hulk Hogan, Steve Austin, The Rock.
It's too long, then.
No, it can't fit that much.
Whatever. Who cares? I don't care. We'll sacrifice those views for a funny title.
This is a historic edition of Review Away because we are doing our first Twitter poll to determine next week's review. With the passing of Nick Bockwinkel, we both suggested that we do some kind of AWA review. And the two options are the WWE's documentary they released a number of years ago and AWA Super Clash from 1985.
Why that show?
Because it's up in its entirety on YouTube.
Yeah.
And Nick Bockwinkel's on the show. And there's actually, it's a pretty, from a name perspective, I mean, an incredible list of talent on the show, including the recently retired Tenryu, who retired this past weekend.
Yeah, great.
His retirement match, I understand, you're going to go seek out.
I think so. You strongly suggest it. So.
I think you need to watch it.
I will.
I want to see what you think about it.
Absolutely.
So we will update this poll at the end of the show. We are at 55 votes since we just posted this about 10 minutes ago. We're going to see how big it grows, but no update as of right now. We're going to keep everyone in suspense.
Yeah, we should actually do a poll like before every show and let the poll continue.
Well, we did it on Monday night for Raw.
Oh, that's right. Yes. I also
Shocking answers.
Yeah. I also talked about the Tenryu match actually on Monday night.
Oh, that's right. Did you watch it on Monday?
I actually did watch it on Monday.
Oh. I thought you just said you were going to go rewatch it. Get a second opinion
it.
On
okay.
your first Got evaluation it. From Monday.
Ah, I see.
You're not fooling anyone, you fucking idiots. Way of the Survivor Series of 1990. You know, I want to give my podcast hosting endorsement to a site that I use as a great resource at times. It's called thehistoryofwwe.com that Graham Cawthorn runs and who's just got an incredible history of match results from every promotion by year. And one of the things that was incredible I found, I'm just going to pull this up, just looking up kind of, stuff that was going on at the time.
Is this updated to this day?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Pretty impressive. Just
like including house shows.
Everything is on this. And that's why it's so staggering when you look at, here they are. The Survivor Series was on Thanksgiving night, which was November 22nd. And then you look at the road schedule that these guys had. Split crews the next day in South Bend, Indiana, and Chicago. Then we go to Saturday. How many house shows do you think they had on that Saturday?
Two?
They had four shows.
Four shows.
They had a matinee show in Landover, Maryland.
Wow.
Then they had a show in Detroit, apparently in front of only 1,800 people, which is not great, with Ultimate Warrior and Savage on top. Then they had a show in Madison Square Garden that same night, and there was also a show in Pittsburgh in the afternoon. This company, I mean, they were running these guys to the damn bone in 1990.
Jeez.
And, I mean, not to say that it is problematic of future issues, but you look at up and down this cardway, this was it was a telling show. From a visual standpoint,
yeah.
From a schedule standpoint, and probably not a lifestyle that would be recommended by your physician would be my best guess as to the culture in 1990. But on that down note, we go to the show that was built around an egg.
Mm-hmm.
The egg, the mysterious egg, was going to hatch at this specific time on the specific night in this specific city of Hartford, Connecticut, on Thursday night, November the 22nd, live on pay-per-view. And as we have learned over the years, when you tease a surprise, you open up people's imagination to millions of different things. So you better have something great. That is the rule.
Yeah,
pretty
much.
That is what everyone speculates.
Yeah, there are two debuts on this show.
Yes, one memorable, one more memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to discuss both of them.
I think The Undertaker should have really hatched out of that.
Hey, I bet you that was probably at one point thought of. In fact, I think
really?
It was at one point.
The Undertaker coming out of an egg?
I cannot say my memory completely confirms that thought, but it might have been.
Wow.
Later on in the show, we're going to run an interview as well from 2010 with the late Paul Bearer, who joined us on The Law and talked a lot about his run with The Undertaker, being paired together, and kind of an overview of The Undertaker, this being the 25th anniversary of the character this past week, and going into Survivor Series this weekend. So that is coming up later on in the show, as we will discuss The Undertaker. But Survivor Series opened with one of the staples of a late 80s, early 90s show, and that was of Vince McMahon caffeine infused open that I could listen to this man yell for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't get tired of it. These openings were so fun. They got you so jacked for these shows. Whether you were ready or not, by the end of it, it was like, Jesus Christ, it's Survivor Series time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to see Boris Zukov.
The Survivor Series, the epitome of tag team competition, is the immortal Hulk Hogan and the Earthquake, captain of respective teams of the Big Boss Man and Deal Bravo. Joining up with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Haku, Tugboat, the Barbarian, the Hulkamaniacs versus the Natural Disasters. Team captains, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, and the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Join up with Coco Beware and a mystery partner, along with the Anvil, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Bret Hart, the Honky Tonk Man, the Dream Team versus the Million Dollar Team. It's the Survivor Series!
They had a weird display, though, of the teams where they would introduce, he would name the captains whose faces would come up. And then they'd add one person from one team and one from the other. So it was like you're building the teams instead of going one by one of who's on whose team.
It was, yeah.
I'm sure that there is some term in television or just in basic physics that this is not the way to fuck with someone's head. There's a linear version of explaining teams, and this was not it, it felt like.
I honestly didn't pay that much attention to that.
And then our announce team was Gorilla Monsoon and Roddy Piper, who was doing very little wrestling at this particular time in 1990, the odd show that he was doing, but primarily an announcer at this point in time. Roddy Piper has did he grow on you as the show progressed? Was he too much for you? What did you like or dislike about Roddy Piper in the color role?
I didn't like him at all.
Oh.
You know, obviously, as a great energy, it was too much energy. And pretty much the complete opposite of how I feel right now. I'm pretty much the complete antithesis of Roddy Piper on this show. Not to say that, you know, either one's great. Oh, I just saw...
I know. And I'm looking at your contract. That definitely probably overmodulated.
Yeah. Anyway, but I just thought he was too loud. He was like on a 12 out of 10 the entire show. And it just got grating on me.
Yeah, well, they were going through this transition because Jesse Ventura had left the company and he had been their color guy and someone that, I mean, largely regarded as one of the best color guys of all time. And him and Gorilla Monsoon, they were my favorite pay-per-view tandem, my favorite broadcasting team at that point in time. I mean, any of those old home videos that you rent, Gorilla and Jesse, it was just a fun two guys that you want to hear call this show for the next 3 hours.
And what did you think of Piper?
I thought Roddy Piper, at times, I thought he had a... I liked some of his explanation of different strategies involved in the Survivor Series, but I'm much like you that I thought he was a lot to take on a show. I never want the announcer to be constantly on my mind during the show.
He's just screaming the entire show.
Yeah, it was very over the top, and that's a lot to take. Even on a kind of condensed show as this one, this only clocked in at 2 hours and 21 minutes, a shorter show than usual. But
10 of those minutes being the hatching of this gobbledygooker.
Yeah, hopefully we'll spend a fraction of that recapping that bizarre segment in WWF history. But as Gorilla Monsoon and Roddy Piper welcome us to the show, they had plugged the matches, as well trying a new concept this year called the Grand Finale Match, where they were going to have the survivors of all the different matches compete in a super match at the end of the night and have the ultimate survivors. It was something different than prior years, the prior three Survivor Series events they had presented. I guess the idea that we are crowning something, there's an ultimate winner at the end of the night. I have to say, the way this played out and all the different booking of different eliminations, and the fact that this concept never returned, I wasn't a huge fan of it, to be honest. And the idea of getting to see these guys wrestle twice in one night didn't do a whole lot for me.
No, it didn't really make – I mean, you got to see Hogan twice. You got to see Warrior twice. And I suppose that might have been a benefit to some of the people watching this show. But I don't necessarily think it added all that much.
It seemed that it was almost unnecessary in the sense that in order for them to make this match – Hulk Hogan had to win his match. Ultimate Warrior had to win their match.
Yeah.
You got the celebration. Mm-hmm. And you could have ended the show very similar. And conversely, you had to come up with all these different ways to – at this particular time, you're heating up Sergeant Slaughter to get a run with the title and headline WrestleMania. You have other heels you want to protect, The Undertaker included. You had to come up with all these weird ways to eliminate these guys while not damaging them too much. Mm-hmm. And it just became that this – presented more problems for you than there was benefit at the end of the show.
Agreed.
They also mentioned the Brontosaurus egg that is over there, and Piper saying that that egg could feed an army as his silky smooth segue into the pay-per-view being available on the Armed Forces Network, and telling President Bush to take that drumstick out of your mouth that you're having with the troops, and then goes to cut the first of what would be a couple promos on Saddam Hussein.
Mr. President Saddam Hussein, I'm charging you double. We gonna make you pay through the nose.
As the Gulf War was occurring at this particular time with U.S. troops over there and the WWF being about as subtle as a hammer with their patriotism on this particular show and leading up to one of the strangest heel promos that I can ever recall from one Sergeant Slaughter.
Oh, yes.
We will get to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okerlund is with the Ultimate Warrior backstage. This was one of my favorite responses I've ever heard to the question, what are your thoughts on blank? And Warrior responded, sorry, Hawk responded, I don't know what my thoughts are exactly. Very honest man. And a lot of yelling. It ended with Warrior talking about the little warriors, the little tornadoes, and the little doomers.
Doomers.
The doomers.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a compliment. Like, oh, no, you're going to be a doom and gloomer.
It should have been like legionnaires.
The legionnaires. Yeah. I guess Road Warriors were out of the question. They couldn't borrow that name for this specific reason. This was actually Animal labeling all the different fan bases. None that hit the level of Canaanites or Testicles. And just an inaudible promo from Ultimate Warrior, who ended it by saying, there is no poison, no creation, and no medicine to cure what we have.
Oh, no. Did he say that?
Those were his words.
Oh, boy.
But to me, it's... the poison and the medicine, those would be contradictory forces, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Like you...
Why would you use poison to cure what you have?
Oh, wait. Well, that would be a horrible idea.
Well, he says there's no medicine to cure the poison that we have.
No, he said there is no poison, no creation, and no medicine to cure what we have.
Right.
He could have made this a logical explanation, saying there is no medicine to cure the poison that we are about to inject the perfect team with, because we have the perfect vial of poison.
Well, I'm sure if anybody were to analyze the words of an Ultimate Warrior promo, they'd come up with more contradictions and inconsistencies.
You know what? A free idea to throw out there to somebody with the time. There is a great concept out there of finding Ultimate Warrior promos and figuring out what the hell was the message of this promo. What were in a sentence or two, what was he trying to say? And then finding a Nick Bockwinkel promo with the same thesis and putting these videos together where we get the same message delivered from such different places.
Yeah.
They could not be further apart than Vancouver from Osaka, Japan.
Yeah, somebody should make like a... Have you been on the website Rap Genius?
Nope.
Or
missed that.
It's called Genius, but they basically...
Oh, they're just very high. It's like, wait a minute. We're limiting ourselves to rap.
Let me explain. Rap Genius is a website, a database of rap lyrics, and if you click on specific lyrics, it allows you to allows people to basically type in their own explanation of what those lyrics mean.
That's cool.
It's a great idea. And
that could totally be done for wrestling promos.
Exactly. Somebody should make like a Wrestling Genius.
Do you want me to censor this out?
No. No. You guys can have it. But realistically, the only thing you really need to Decipher is Ultimate Warrior promo, and maybe a handful full of other people. Maybe like a Bray Wyatt promo as well.
Maybe this is a job for Matthew.
Sure. He can have that. But anyway, back to the show. Man, just the screaming. I actually enjoy it in this scenario. Not so much in my color commentary, but everybody here is screaming at the top of their lungs, but I think everybody also had these great, very well understood ideas of who their individual characters were. And that was really fun to see. It was really fun to see them do them in this style, one after the other. But poor Mean Gene here just looks so uncomfortable, sandwiched into this tight shot with all these guys.
I've got to say that between the Survivor Series show and watching all these Nick Bockwinkel promos over the last couple of days, my God, was Gene Okerlund so good.
He was.
I just thought this guy was the perfect guy to be in this role that could just set up any of these maniacs to cut any promo. He just had such a great poise. I think Gene Okerlund, tremendous talent, probably not news to most people. So that takes us to our first Survivor Series elimination match. The Warriors. Always a fun part of these traditional Survivor Series shows are the names that they would come up with. Sadly, these team names don't exist anymore, and now we have to rely on independent talent coming in and being renamed as our source of laughter. The Warriors, consisting of the Ultimate Warrior, the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, Animal, and Hawk, against the perfect team of Mr. Perfect, Axe Smash, and Crush. Really, this was just simply finding a name for the captain, and really the other participants of the team were there was no inclusion of their identity to the team name.
No, you're one of me now.
The Perfect Demolishers. Also worth noting here is the fact that Kerry Von Erich came out with the Intercontinental title. However, it was a few nights prior he had actually dropped the title to Mr. Perfect, but that match would not air on television until December. So Mr. Perfect was in fact the champion here, but not identified as such in our pre-spoiler, pre-internet world of 1990. Mm. And this match, what do you think the budget was for tassels, sequins, and face paint?
There was a lot of that.
There was a lot of gimmickry in this particular match.
The pairings were definitely interesting here because you have Demolition and the Ultimate Warrior in this match. Two gimmicks that, you know, I think were largely influenced by the look of the Road Warriors. And they're all in the same match.
They were the legit Legionnaires.
Yes.
Big fans. Animal attacked Smash to start. And the crowd got into it right away as they were double-teaming Smash and then Mr. Perfect. Tornado came in with a claw onto Axe. That was broken up, and then Warrior hit a flying shoulder block and a running splash to eliminate Axe. Then they got the advantage on Warrior as Piper is asking which one just got eliminated, and the answer was Axe. Hawk comes in. Piper, you could tell there were times like he did not know the difference between one guy and the next in certain tag teams.
Piper didn't even know the difference between the two Rockers.
No, it was always the Rocker he would identify them as. When one was in the ring. Hawk came in with Perfect. There was an Irish whip, and Perfect just stumbling into the corner and then knocks his head into the turnbuckle. Then there was this big brawl, and it led to Legion of Doom and Demolition all fighting. Hawk kicks away at the ref, and all four men, Smash, Crush, Animal, and Hawk, are disqualified. And this would be a common theme throughout this show. How the hell do we get rid of these people? And here were the first four examples of how we would get our way out of this.
There are just like so many cop-outs of finishes in these elimination matches. I mean, if you look at the number of matches on this show, what is it, like five elimination matches? There are set to be a lot of eliminations. So a lot of them were just done, I'd say, pretty sloppily in fashion like this.
And again, you had this certain window of time to present all of these matches, and because of this grand finale match, you couldn't just do all these matches where you have three or four survivors. You had to wipe out teams so that you had a manageable number on the babyface and heel side. Mm-hmm. Essentially, eight people were going to be going to the main finale match. So you had to do all these other eliminations. And again, it was another obstacle that they put in front of themselves.
Yeah. And in the end, it just created a lot of very unrealistic finishes. I mean, the number of count-out finishes that eliminated guys on the show, the refs must have been counting to five, because I don't even think they took the time to count to 10.
One of the main conclusions at the end of some of these matches were, most of these guys really don't care about this kind of a match. It's like, I could win or lose this. If I'm distracted, I'm out of here. Yeah. And making their way to the back as they would forget what match was going on. Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, attacks Mr. Perfect, and Gorilla Monsoon, being as accurate as possible, said, the IC champion versus the former IC champion.
Wow.
Keeping it vague, but accurate.
Nice. Yeah.
Warrior then runs Perfect and Heenan into one another, and then Heenan gets tossed over the barricade. Von Erich runs shoulder first into the post and then into the exposed buckle, and Mr. Perfect hits the Perfect Plex, eliminating the Texas Tornado. And if that was the title match that you were going to be seeing on TV, here was a reason to have it, along with Mr. Perfect being the former champion. Warrior then dives into the exposed buckle, and Perfect continues with the Perfect Plex. This time, Warrior kicks out. Perfect is beating down on him, bumping all over for his comeback, almost in a comedic way, just overselling for Warrior. And then runs him in with the shoulder block and the splash, and pins Mr. Perfect in 14 minutes and 21 seconds. And Warrior's trunks had the airbrushing on it. The only survivor, spoiling his own match.
Yes.
Beforehand.
Yes.
Where was the warning there?
He should have painted a spoiler tag.
Should have censored his trunks until after the match.
That's right.
Or at least wait a week or two.
Yeah, this match was a bit of a, sad snapshot, obviously, because of,
Thanks. Thanks, gloomy one.
Well, I'm just saying.
Like, yeah, this whole show is, it's sad. I mean, in this match, who did we have? Warrior, Kerry Von Erich, Hawk, Mr. Perfect, and Bryan Adams. It's...
So, unfortunate. The match also wasn't really all that great, but what you really notice from the get-go is just this crowd and how hot they were for everything. I think it's almost, you could say, a little unfair to watch these shows hoping to watch see technical wrestling.
Oh, I don't think that's the value of these shows.
No.
This is nostalgia. It's a lot of people's childhoods.
It's loud gimmicks and loud personalities, and they definitely seem to deliver with all these matches.
Yep, and this was a big show at the time, did very well on pay-per-view. Full crowd in Hartford. Those are the measures of success for that company in 1990. Not to say their business was on fire in 1990, but this show did well, given all the characters that were involved, and it's characters that have a very lasting effect up to the present in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Mooney is with the Million Dollar Team backstage, including Virgil and Jimmy Hart, as Virgil was counting that fuck money.
That's right.
DiBiase says that Coco Beware is another bird that will be plucked and stuffed this Thanksgiving, and just cut a great promo running down the entire Dream Team.
Yeah, I love DiBiase's promos on this show. I mean, he didn't have the typical yelling style. I mean, he did kind of yell in his own register, but it was not drink a ton of coffees and maybe ingest some other substances and then screaming at the camera. I really like DiBiase a lot.
It tells you, certainly some of the depth. The company wasn't exactly brimming with top-end heels. That was part of the reason they brought Sergeant Slaughter back with this idea to headline WrestleMania. But, you had guys like Kurt Hennig, like Ted DiBiase, who got a taste of the main event picture, but never were put in that role. And that tells you something, because I think a Ted DiBiase today, with that kind of a gimmick, he wouldn't be cutting the promos he did in 1990. But nonetheless, a guy like that in the ring, with that promo ability, a great gimmick, this guy would have won countless world titles, given the frequent title changes and just the standard. This guy was not viewed to be the top guy to get a run with the title throughout his career in the WWF. I think that says something to kind of the exclusive nature of who they had reserved to hold the title.
Mm-hmm.
So the Dream Team consisted of Dusty Rhodes, Coco Beware, Bret Hart and Jim the Anvil Neidhart taking on the million-dollar team of Ted DiBiase, the Honky Tonk Man, Greg the Hammer Valentine, and their mystery partner.
Everybody's got a price for the million-dollar man. So without further ado, I will introduce to you now my mystery partner, led to the ring by his manager, Brother Love, weighing in at 320 pounds from Death Valley, I give you The Undertaker.
The Undertaker, the mystery partner, is now revealed.
I never heard of him.
Oh, take a
look. Holy cow. Look at the size of that ham hock. Check out them drumsticks, baby.
320 pounds looks to be 6'9", 6'10", somewhere in that neighborhood, Rod.
6'10"? I don't know. It's hard to tell from here. Holy cow!
Who was introduced as the Undertaker?
320 pounds from Death Valley.
That being WCW. I'm sure that was a knock against them. This guy who is risen from the dead of his Mean Mark days. So The Undertaker came out as best you can try, and this is very difficult to do with hindsight and the success of the gimmick, the character. What do you think your reaction would have been to The Undertaker in 1990?
I mean, in the context of the rest of this show with the rest of these gimmicks, I didn't think.
Yeah, try and put yourself in 1990. I think today, a character like this, I don't know how well it would be received, but even in 1990.
You have to remember, like, this show felt very much geared towards children. And at the time, I mean, watching back now, this was really corny. But at the time, he came out and looked like
The vast majority of The Undertaker's career, you could say,
very corny,
can be very corny. You could categorize it as.
Yeah. But at the time, I mean, I thought he looked pretty cool, and he played it, despite it being so cartoony, he played it very seriously. You know what I mean? He took it very seriously. This is a walking giant zombie.
I thought for the time, this was a great gimmick. But one that if you had told me 3 years into it, he'd still be doing this.
Oh, no way.
I never would have bought it.
Yeah.
I never would have thought this guy could have gotten 5 years out of this character, much less 25. And in many ways, you can say it's the greatest character that that company has ever conceived. And I put a lot of that on the guy playing the role.
Absolutely.
Because there have been similar characters that, effective in their introduction, who have had nowhere close to the success or staying power that he has.
What do you think the Warlord would look like today?
If Mark Calloway had come in?
If you got the Warlord in, like,
MC wand?
I mean, because part of the reason why The Undertaker obviously has been so long-lasting is because of the constant evolution and the updating of his character. And so let's say you take an 80s character that appeared on this show. I like to imagine what, you know, what, for instance, name somebody. Name a really cartoony guy here.
The Barbarian?
Yeah, what would the Barbarian look like in 2015?
Yeah, would the biker version of the Barbarian have looked like? That, like, Taker coming out as the biker Taker.
Oh, okay.
I mean, same name, but completely different presentation.
I don't know.
We could have had a UFC fighter version Barbarian.
Oh, yes, yeah. Okay.
Brings out his niece, Lady Tapa.
MMA gloves on a Barbarian.
You know, the Warlord, up until a few weeks ago, was one of the most well-known bodyguards of Kimbo Slice. Now, I'm sorry, Dada 5000 is...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The Warlord, sir, he did work for a time as one of Kimbo Slice's bodyguards.
You think he got a call from Scott Coker?
Very doubtful.
Yeah.
I don't know how well Terry Zopinski is getting around these days. I think he's like 53 now.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean there's never the chance that Ryzen doesn't call him.
How old is Ken Shamrock?
Ken Shamrock's going to be 52 come that fight with Hoist Gracie. So, I mean, the Warlord. I will say, the Undertaker character, it's one that I've always looked at that, I mean, in the wrestling world, this is a character that every fan understands. He is protected. He's presented as a legend.
Mm-hmm.
It was really something to see him just recently identified on The Tonight Show by Jimmy Fallon. And the crowd reacted to this guy, whether they were just applauding like this – crazy character, whether they really knew the Undertaker character. I mean, he came out and it was just an insane reaction to this guy. Granted, it was a pretty ridiculous setup to all of this. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it's like this was a somebody that I think people know who the Undertaker is, even if you're not a big wrestling fan.
Yeah, I mean, the Undertaker, I don't think has ever been viewed on the same mainstream level as a Rock or Steve Austin or Hulk Hogan. But nonetheless, his appearances every year at WrestleMania is almost as big of a deal, you know, as say somebody showing up, you know, making very rare appearances. And I thought it was really cool and really telling to see that even in the mainstream, he gets that type of recognition.
Yeah, and it all goes back to this particular night where he came out.
Yeah, and something, you know, something that I think is a little understated too is the fact that, I mean, obviously the entrance of The Undertaker has always been a big thing, but I'd say the major part of that, you know, even without all the pyro, is the theme music. And that was already apparent even here. He's pretty much had the same theme, you know, barring the Limp Bizkit and the Kid Rock. But he's pretty much had that same graveyard theme the entire time. And it was cool hearing this early version of it. Much, much more minimal, but, you know, the same melody.
There was so much that went into this character, from the elaborate wardrobe that was put together for him, the music, the look, just the walk to the ring.
Yep.
It felt completely awkward that Brother Love was attached to him, and that would be a very short-lived affiliation before Paul Bearer obviously became a much more natural manager for him at the time. But also, he was originally identified as Kane the Undertaker before they ditched the Kane name.
Yeah, he wasn't on this show.
He wasn't on this show. However, on television, he was referred to it a few times.
So what exactly was the build-up? Because I wasn't watching at this time. How did they?
This was just a mystery opponent. There wasn't lot of build-up to this. And he had done a few small matches just in the week or so prior to this. So this wasn't his first match with the company. But I think obviously it was the first televised match for The Undertaker. So he comes out, and the immediate words used to describe The Undertaker by Roddy Piper to give us the introduction to this character, he said, "Look at the size of that hemhock. Check out those drumsticks." And Piper, I mean, to Monsoon and Piper's credit, they sold this guy as just being this monster and it's selling fear. The close-up shots of his eyes with the purple makeup under the eyes. And I will say, this was probably the fastest Undertaker entrance in history. By his standards, he bolted to the ring.
Sure.
Not that long, drawn-out walk and several-minute intro.
No motorcycle.
It's fairly quick.
No motorcycle.
No. The motorcycle was not revving up to go in Hartford. Quite the contrast to Rhythm and Blues, who came out to Honka Honka Honky Love. With a black-haired Greg Valentine. So DiBiase was the one who introduced him with the manager, Brother Love. And then the match begins with The Undertaker and Bret. And Piper brought up the fact that Bret Hart was dedicating this match to his brother, Dean, who had died the day prior from a kidney disease at the age of 36.
Wow.
And it was very strange because this happened this year at the Survivor Series, and then the following year at the Survivor Series, someone made a prank call to the arena they were at saying that Stu had died. And
on this show?
The following year's Survivor Series. So here you are, like a year removed from your brother dying, and some asshole prank calls the arena saying that Stu had died. And being that it was 1991, not the easiest thing to just suddenly get the actual story immediately. And it's just very strange. But dedicating the match to his brother Dean, and outside of The Undertaker, I thought this was a pretty big spotlight that they placed on Bret, which was a certain value of the Survivor Series, was the ability to isolate some guys. And this was several months away from Bret peeling off from Jim Neidhart and becoming a singles wrestler. This way was my favorite match of the show. I thought it was laid out so well. It helped a lot of people. It started with Taker and Brett. Then Coco came in and landed neck first on the top, and we get our very first tombstone, and called the tombstone, as The Undertaker eliminates Coco Beware. And then he was just no-selling Brett's strikes, tagged in Valentine. Neidhart came in with a power slam to Honky Tonk Man, eliminating him. Then Dusty came in with Ted DiBiase, which was the feud that was going on at the time. And Dusty hits a drop kick to Ted DiBiase. Pretty spectacular by Dusty standards. Virgil then grabs the leg of Neidhart. This allowed DiBiase to get the advantage and pin Neidhart. Taker was then in with Dusty, kicked them in the gut, and then Taker gets on top and hits a double axe handle and pins Dusty Rhodes clean, as Roddy Piper is referring to Blubber Love on the floor. Dusty then goes after Brother Love in the aisle and gets beaten down by The Undertaker up the aisle, and The Undertaker gets counted out. And Roddy Piper says,
"The Undertaker has been counted out."
Oh,
he lets the legal man in. Oh, yes, he looks scary. He's big, but he's dumb.
But he's dumb. And The Undertaker gets counted out.
Yeah.
And this, to me, was one of your problems of this stupid grand finale match, was that this match, to me, the number one priority was The Undertaker and introducing a brand new big heel, but somehow we had to eliminate this guy. And they did the best they could to get rid of him, but nonetheless, not the most ideal, I feel.
Isn't it more of a problem of the elimination format of the match itself?
I think that if you didn't have this grand finale, you could have still had... I mean, here's the problem. If this was just a straight-up regular Survivor Series match with no grand finale, mm-hmm. I mean, the heels were still going to win this match.
Yeah.
But then you run into the problem that Undertaker has to get eliminated in the grand finale match. I think there wouldn't have been any problem with DiBiase and Undertaker winning this match and surviving. DiBiase was not the priority that The Undertaker was going to be. They had a lot invested in this character. They wanted to give him a big debut. And because of this grand finale deal, you had to come up with ways to get rid of someone like The Undertaker on his first night. So he is counted out, and the match continues. Valentine went for a figure four, and Brett turned it into a small package, eliminating Valentine. And that took us to Bret Hart and Ted DiBiase for the final fall. And the crowd was very hot for this, and playing up the story of Bret and dedicating this match to his brother. There was an atomic drop that sent DiBiase over the top to the floor, and then followed with a pescado to DiBiase, sent him into the post, and then back into the ring. Hart did that Irish whip where he runs chest first into the turnbuckle, and then DiBiase is down. Hart trips and teases a knee injury, and it sets up this great near fall as he's playing possum with the knee injury, and it was a spot Brett would bring out every now and then. Virgil then holds Brett. DiBiase misses and knees Virgil, and the crowd goes nuts. They get another great near fall, and DiBiase takes a mid-ring crossbody, flips over, and lands on top of Brett and gets the pinfall in 14 minutes as Brett sits up and yells, "Fuck," after he gets caught by Ted DiBiase. This was, as I said, I thought this was my favorite match on the show. I thought the match was laid out really great. I thought Taker looked really good in this match. Just the limited offense he had, did that spot off the top rope. And you did a lot for Brett in this match, I thought.
I thought so, too. I thought Brett showed a lot of sophistication in his in-ring ability compared to much of the rest of the roster here. It really felt like, you know, he was a man from a different era wrestling with all these bodybuilders. And I think this match is remembered for Taker's debut, but I thought Brett was clearly the focus breakout babyface of the group in the match itself. I thought they treated Taker tremendously. They gave him a win over the team captain here, Dusty Rhodes. And so it was beneficial, definitely. A pretty historically significant match.
Yes, and they were also plugging throughout the show their NBC special that they would have the next night with the Ultimate Warrior against Ted DiBiase for the WWF title. So certainly there was the need to somewhat protect Ted DiBiase on this particular show. Then we went to a very strange interview. Not as strange as the one we just watched at the beginning, but Gene Okerlund with Jake Roberts, Jimmy Snuka, and the Rockers in the shower.
Yeah.
They didn't have much of an explanation for being in the shower. Jake was nursing his left eyeball injury at the time after Rick Martel had sprayed the Arrogance cologne into his eye. And Jake had this, I guess, like contact, this pure white contact lens that he would wear. So it looked like he had no pupil in his eye. And it looked utterly hideous looking. And you couldn't you couldn't take your eye off it.
Is that what happens when you get sprayed, like when you're nursing an injury?
Your pupil disappears. And you can't see out of the left side of your face. But you will be allowed to wrestle given your limited vision.
Yeah. That was a nice effect. Nice visual effect. I have no idea. Why were they in the shower?
I have no idea at all. And they only let Jake speak, which was for the best. And Jake identifies his teammates and says about Jimmy Snuka, "This man has the scars of time written all over his face." And then dares the other team to rattle the tree and see if Damien falls out of it. So that took us to our next match with the Visionaries.
Because, who were they named after?
Because of what they did to Jake Roberts.
Oh.
What Martel did to him.
I get it.
Yeah, they can see. Yeah. That's the heat. Rick Martel, the model Rick Martel, with Paul Roma, Hercules, and the Warlord.
Yeah, I thought...
What a team, way.
I thought Hercules was going to be a shoe-in for the Putski Award on this show.
No way. I don't even know if top five on this show, way.
But, dude, the Warlord...
He wasn't even the top one in this match. Not even close.
The Warlord, Snuka, no slouch either.
Jimmy Snuka, mind you, with this body, 47 years old.
Really? Wow.
47. And Jimmy Snuka in tights and boots, too, which...
Incredible.
I don't know if he was the blind one dressing himself, but this he had, like, the leopard tights with, like, this rainbow-colored boots. Like, just the actual definition of this color scheme would be vomit. He looked terrible. Their opponents were the Vipers, Jake Roberts, Jimmy Snuka, Shawn Michaels, and Marty Jannetty. Jannetty started off the match with the Warlord and could not take him off his feet. The Warlord ends up running into Roma in the corner, and the Rockers then double-team the Warlord to get him down. Piper calls them the best athletes in the world when Michaels and Martel were in. The best athletes in the world. That's saying something. Snuka comes in with his boots. Drop kicks Warlord. Jannetty comes off the turnbuckle into a power slam, and Warlord eliminates Jannetty. Then Warlord catches Michaels, and Jake shoves him, and Michaels turns it into a Hurricane Rana, tags in Jake, and then Piper is referring to Michaels here as the Rocker. The Rocker is in there.
He definitely didn't know his name.
He did not know Shawn Michaels from Marty Jannetty. Says the Rockers will be the team of the 90s, and Power and Glory could be number two.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had Jake's vision for that in terms of the number two tag team of the 90s. The heels beat down on Shawn Michaels. Michaels does the flare flip into the corner. They finally tag Snuka back in. Martel reverses a cross body and grabs the tights to pin Snuka. So he's eliminated, and it is now is 4-on-2 in favor of the Visionaries. Hercules avoids a DDT, escapes to the floor, and then Martel clotheslines Jake from the outside of the apron, gets the advantage on him. Roma misses a fist from the top rope. Jake then tags in Michaels. Did you notice the referee on the floor throughout the night?
Yeah, Shane McMahon.
Shane McMahon, a very young Shane McMahon, just taking in the action as the...
What was his role? What's the floor?
Well, there's eight men out there. There's a lot of bodies to take care of, so you need some backup officials. Then we had a superplex top rope splash combo, which Power and Glory used to eliminate Michaels. So it's now 4-on-1, and the crowd got on their feet cheering for Jake, the one-eyed Jake the Snake Roberts. Jake gets out of a bear hug, catches a DDT, but the referee is distracted, and this leads to Martel spraying Arrogance at Jake. And Jake avoids the spray to the eyes, grabs Damian and chases off Martel all the way to the back. And unfortunately, Jake gets himself counted out because he chased Martel with a snake at the 18-minute, 6-second mark. And Hercules, Roma, Warlord, and Martel survive because Rick Martel was not the legal man when he got chased to the back. So all four survive and will join Ted DiBiase in the grand finale match.
I like the story told of all the heels on one team surviving. I find that, you know, pretty unique and unexpected in a match like this. But I thought the finish was, again, a real cop-out and kind of made Jake look cowardly.
He had one eye. Could only see out of the right side of his head.
Well, given all that, I don't think it would have hurt him that much to take the fall here to actually give a conclusive finish.
Well, there was a lot of protecting going on this particular show for numerous baby faces and some heels as well. They plugged the Royal Rumble, which would be Saturday night in January, a Saturday night pay-per-view, eh? Would you prefer Saturday night wrestling pay-per-views?
We watch UFCs on Saturday.
Yeah. But WWE, they've kind of just kept Sundays to themselves. Sean Mooney is with Hogan, Duggan, Tugboat, and the Big Boss Man. And they're dedicating this match to the men and women serving the U.S. and the Middle East. And then Hogan volunteers their services for President Bush to go fight.
Okay.
Could you imagine being a soldier and all of a sudden you turn to the right and there's Tugboat doing his toot toot sign as they get ready to run into battle. And Hacksaw's got his 2x4. Big Boss Man's twirling his nightstick. And Hulk Hogan is telling everybody about how we've got 93,000 wrestlers on our way to join the fight. Some exaggerated tale.
That'd be quite the scene.
What a documentary that would have been. Mm. WWF versus the world.
Mm.
Well, not the world. Specific part of the world. Then another threat to Saddam Hussein. So you can put Hogan and Piper on the list of cutting promos on Saddam. Hogan, Bossman, Tugboat, and Jim Duggan. First of all, before we talk about this, we kind of talked about this when we reviewed the 91 Royal Rumble, where they were very heavy into the whole Gulf War going on at the time. We talk about trying to view the Undertaker gimmick in 1990. How would you have felt if a wrestling fan with a wrestling company that was pretty much hitting this real war that's going on pretty hard, and there were certainly self-serving reasons to this, of building up Hulk Hogan as this baby face and using the war as a storyline. Like, I think about that today.
Go ahead.
Like, if we were to have baby faces come out on Raw and start cutting promos on ISIS and bringing up the attacks in France, I think that is gross, just the idea of that.
Well,
that was what was going on here in 1990.
I mean, as recent as, you know, 9/11, or, you know, when Bin Laden was announced dead, that was all made pretty public on WWE.
And
Raw.
Was rightfully scrutinized.
Yeah, we definitely live in a different time, but things like this aren't necessarily that uncommon. I mean, look at the character of Captain America in comic books, you know? He was created as propaganda. And, you know, he's a beloved character to this day. I mean, I think there's a certain place, you know, for patriotism in an American-produced TV show. People want heroes. And, you know, what's a bigger hero than the war, the soldier defending your country in the war?
I think, though, that the if it were to happen today, I think the story aspect would be second to a company that would be capitalizing on real tragedy that is happening in the world for self-serving interest.
Well, is it capitalizing, or is it simply providing an audience with what they want in a war hero as your main character?
I don't feel over the course of history that the WWF has built themselves up to be this outlet of entertainment that has creative license to tell stories in that direction. I think the WWE, to a vast amount of the general public, has a very sleazy reputation, and I think that this would be playing to that stereotype.
But it doesn't mean that they have to abide by that reputation. I mean, them doing it here, Was it sleazy? I don't know, but I'd say for probably a vast majority of the audience, they bought into Hogan as, you know, the guy rallying the troops, rallying patriotism.
Well, their opposition on this night was the natural disasters of Earthquake, Dino Bravo, Haku, and the Barbarian, whose niece is fighting on the Ryzen Fighting Federation card on New Year's Eve. So that is our connection. So the Hulkamaniacs were out, each one getting their own entrance, including Tugboat. This was a big night in his career.
Yeah.
What? The Master of Shock. The Boss Man comes in. He immediately pins Haku after hitting a side slam. Then Boss Man runs Bobby Heenan into the post from the apron, and the Barbarian gets the advantage on Boss Man. And Piper is explaining the strategy, stating that they're trying to go too fast and they're making mistakes and they don't have the same speed as the Rockers. Almost outlining maybe some strategy tips for Ronda Rousey.
She was going
too fast and she's going to make mistakes. Jimmy Hart then pulls down the top rope and Duggan plunges to the floor and then chases Jimmy Hart with his 2x4, comes into the ring and swats Earthquake with it, and Jim Duggan gets disqualified. Moron.
The limitations that they put on themselves. I don't know why. How is Jim Duggan coming in as a babyface, swinging a weapon at his opponents, getting himself disqualified?
What did Earthquake do?
How is that better than taking a pinfall? You know, it just made Duggan look like a real idiot, much like Jake did.
What do you think John Tenta's reaction was when they decided that we're going to put you in a light blue singlet? This is a large man to put into a singlet. I mean, it's the look you now always associate with Earthquake, but what a curious decision.
Well, you want to show off his size. You put Andre in a singlet.
I just don't. It just looked like it was just such an awkward look.
What
singlet.
Else would you put him in?
I mean, Andre kind of it looked. You know, you had the one-armed singlet. This was a man that just almost came out of the woods or something like that. And John Tenta was just.
You definitely want to show off the bulge, show off the size.
Yeah, I guess they didn't with Golga. They just wanted to cover him up as much as possible. But nonetheless. The match continued with Jim Duggan gone. Hogan finally comes in. He slams Dino Bravo and then Barbarian and then finally slams Earthquake. They drop Hogan. Bravo comes in and Hulk Hogan executes an inside cradle to pin Dino Bravo.
Whoa.
I bet you this one had some rehearsals ahead of time. This was a big move by Hulk Hogan. I mean, how many inside cradles come to the top of mind when thinking of Hulk Hogan matches? But Dino Bravo eliminated. Bossman then got caught coming off the top by Earthquake, but Hogan knocks him down on top for a two count. Barbarian kicks Bossman from the apron, hits an elbow drop, and then Earthquake eliminates Bossman as Piper then immediately says, "Life goes on," with Bossman eliminated. Hogan can't lift up Earthquake, lands on top, and Piper basically calls Hogan an idiot for trying it. Hogan then pulls Earthquake to the floor. Hogan is run back first to the post, and Earthquake and Tugboat, the future Natural Disasters tag team, start going at it, and they're just so enchanted by one another's fists flying that they don't hear the referee counting, and both get counted out.
Wow.
Both gone, Way.
Again, these must have been counts of five because they were incredibly quick.
God, I want to know who put together some of these matches. Outside of the DiBiase elimination match, I thought that was really well laid out. Some of these others, to your point, Way, it was just like, just do a count out. Oh, chase them off with a 2x4. Run to the back.
They're just lazy.
It's like someone pulled out a book. Every cop-out trope we can find is going to be exploited on this particular event.
I think I might have been okay if, let's say, you only had one count out finish this entire show. Like, I felt like we had finishes like this for every match.
Well, there was a reason for this, Way, and that was to give us the, we got Bret Hart and Ted DiBiase, bit of a, if you're a hardcore fan, that was probably a bit of a dream scenario, much like Hulk Hogan and the Barbarian. One-on-one. First time, last time.
Sure. Did we not get one in WCW?
Of these two in a singles match?
Yeah.
I don't know. The Barbarian hit a pile driver to Hulk Hogan, meaning that the Barbarian must have been held in the highest of regard by one Hulk Hogan. Even though Roddy Piper explained that by giving him the pile driver, Hogan's shoulders actually were cushioned by the legs of the Barbarian, like actually explaining how he was like protected on the way down. And I don't even know why they did this pile driver spot, because it was just for a quick kick out spot. And I mean, a pile driver is like a fairly protected move.
Didn't he Hulk up right after?
No, not from that spot. Oh. He ended up taking there was a double clothesline and then a top rope clothesline by Barbarian for a two count, and then he hulked up.
Right.
So the top rope clothesline was the big setup spot, and it was the Hulk Hogan comeback you've seen a million times. Punches, big boot, leg drop, and Hogan is the sole survivor in 14 minutes, 48 seconds. And then afterwards, the guy goes after Bobby Heenan, who ends up taking a bigger bump running into the corner up and over than I think anyone up until this point on the show.
Heenan took a crazy
Heenan outworked this roster on this event.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people grew up with these characters and Hogan, but I didn't necessarily. So I found this match incredibly boring. Just a lot of big, heavy guys with clubbing forearms and boring heavyweight moves. I kept falling asleep during this match. These guys had about the mobility of, like, the LJN figures that were molded after them. But that said, you know, you really do have to admire the way someone like a Hulk Hogan can command this crowd. And to be able to do that with his limited offense, I think just shows how great his timing and his charisma and his facials were. For this style, he really was a tremendous wrestler in that sense.
Yeah, it's also worth noting, whenever we look at some of these shows from a time period like this, you know, so much today, there's such an emphasis on work in the ring and guys that have a pride in how great a match they can have. In 1990, there was so much less of a premium on that, especially in the WWF. These were guys that we outlined just a small fraction of what their schedules looked like, where these guys were just on the road constantly, working hundreds of matches. They were doing the same matches every single night. Their bodies were probably wrecked. They were on God knows what to wake up in the morning, to go to bed at night. This was a cycle of insanity for most of these guys, and it was a different world than even today. Mm-hmm. And that's not discounting that today's schedule is rough. But in 1990, it's like these guys were just getting from one town to the next and probably not even aware where they were sometimes.
Yeah. But, you know, just watching as somebody in 2015, these shows don't really have much replay value if you're looking for good matches. They have replay value if you want to relive the characters, if you want to admire their promos, which I think they all were able to excel at.
Definitely. Then Hogan, a fan, threw in a banner, and Hogan wiped his face of his sweat and threw it back at the fan.
That's just gross.
Yes.
Like, I know it's tradition somewhere. Like, didn't we?
Tanahashi does that.
Yeah, in Japan.
He wipes the towel and then sends it back to the fans.
But I mean, come on.
Jesus did it, I think.
What?
Remember that scene in Forrest Gump where he wipes his face and then they've got like the vision of Jesus?
Oh, okay. Was that it?
I don't
or
know.
Was it the smiley face?
I'm sure when Jesus did his annual Survivor Series match, he would do the same for his fans.
I mean, I know it's tradition and you're a fan, but I mean, Jesus. Like, what kind of Hulk Hogan diseases could he be passing off here?
Don't speculate, Way. That's irresponsible. Gene Okerlund is on the stage in the arena and welcomes out the Macho King, Randy Savage, who is absent from this event. He's carried to the stage by his slaves, I guess, what these people were, and dressed up like a candy cane.
Savage.
Not very Thanksgiving colors. This was more kind of a Christmas version of Randy Savage, who I guess, you know, wasn't booked on this show, so looking ahead to the Christmas season. Okerlund asks Savage about his Thanksgiving dinner and what he ate. And this goes to the theory that these promos, you could ask a guy any question. He knew what his promo was going to be, and he would get that message out, even if he was asked about sweet potatoes in the setup. Savage immediately cuts his promo on becoming the next champion, calls Okerlund one of the biggest turkeys of all time, and then they go over this segment where Sherry came out and slapped the ultimate chicken three times in order for Savage to get a title match, and Warrior would not grant it. and says he is the special one in the WWF. He has proven he is number one. He's going to do that again, and then he might retire. Which would not happen. But that was it for Randy Savage. Just a short cameo on this show. And that took us to the match of all matches, the one that you bought the pay-per-view for. It was the Alliance, not WCW and ECW of 11 years later, but the original Alliance of Nikolai Volkoff, Tito Santana, Bushwhacker Luke, and Bushwhacker Butch.
The Alliance.
The Alliance, yes. Who came out to Lex Luger's future U.S. patriotic theme. And Piper explains that the Russians gave us Volkoff, and in exchange, we gave them MTV and Two Live Crew, and intimating that they certainly got the short end of the stick in Nikolai Volkoff. And then we had the team of Sergeant Slaughter, Boris Zukov, Sato, and Pat Tanaka of the Orient Express, along with General Adnan, come out. And Okerlund interviewed Slaughter in the aisleway while his theme was still playing, which was essentially just a drum being played. Mm-hmm. That was his theme.
Yeah.
And was kind of jarring to hear a promo, especially a slow promo from Slaughter. And Okerlund starts off the promo by telling Slaughter that this is airing on the Armed Forces Network. And the whole team is decked out in war paint. And Slaughter must have said the word despicable about 8 times. He says that they salute one flag, and that is the flag of Iraq. And says something about Thanksgiving dinner that they are going to be enjoying without the smell of camel dung in the air or sand in their pumpkin pie, mocking the soldiers in Saudi Arabia because of the conditions in which they are going to be eating their Thanksgiving dinner. And then warns President Bush about sending troops to Iraq because just like them, they take no prisoners and they are survivors. They are the mercenaries.
What did all of you American gung-ho soldiers out there in Saudi Arabia have in your K-ration kit today? Hot turkey sandwich!
Call yourself an American, you've got to be kidding.
President Bush, take some advice from Sergeant Slaughter before you send your troop into battle against President Saddam Hussein. Always think twice, because the Iraqi army soldier is just like the mercenary and Sergeant Slaughter. We take no prisoners, and we are survivors. And that's an order. You're dismissed, you please.
What a despicable piece of garbage.
Thank you.
This was definitely a bit of a strange promo, especially because it took so long in the setting that it took place in. Like, right there in front of the aisle was not broadcast to the live audience.
I think there was genuine concern of how this audience would react to such a – like, this was a heavy promo considering what was going on in the world at the time.
Sort of a heavy
character. And here we – exactly, and that's what it was brought in for, of just mocking your U.S. soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And this got a ton of backlash, this whole angle going into WrestleMania, which by the time WrestleMania came around, everything had ended with Iraq. However, they went full steam ahead with this, and especially you see at the Royal Rumble where they just went full on with all of it and sending Hulk Hogan to visit troops at bases and using it as publicity. But this was a really heavy-handed promo. And I'm sure it wasn't just a coincidence that they did this in the aisle so that the crowd – and playing the music as well over top of it, so you heard it all clearly at home but not so much in the arena.
Interesting.
Like, there could have been a guy jumping the barricade. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like wrestling bullshit about getting heat like that, but I'm sure that was at least a thought and in doing it in this presentation. Roddy Piper is outraged and repeatedly calls Slaughter a pig and that he would rather eat K rations with the troops than Thanksgiving dinner with Slaughter. So the shit was on.
He was about to pop a blood vessel.
Yes. So the match begins, and we were up against the clock here because Santana immediately pinned Boris Zukov with a flying forearm. This was the easiest night of Zukov's career, and that includes WrestleMania that year where I think they went like under 30 seconds in their match. This was even shorter. This guy was just pin me, pay me. Tanaka then misses a kick and hits his partner Sato as Santana moves out of the way. The Bushwhackers come in, hit the battering ram to Sato, and Butch pins him. Then there's a flying forearm to Tanaka. Santana eliminates him, and it's suddenly 4-on-1 in favor of Sergeant Slaughter. And Volkov comes in with these hideous-looking kicks to Slaughter. Knocks him down, hits some elbow drops. Volkov's head is run into the turnbuckle. Piper points out how slow Sergeant Slaughter is working in order to pace himself against all four. Then he pins Volkov, like, literally out of nowhere. I don't even know what he hit him with. It might have been a punch. The Bushwhackers then double-team Slaughter. Luke comes off the top, into his knees. Gutbuster pins Butch. Then there's a clothesline. Slaughter pins the other Bushwhacker, eliminating Luke, I think it was. Santana then fires up on Slaughter. There's a spinning neckbreaker to Santana. Piper says if you fight a Latin person, you're in for a fight. And then Slaughter shoves Santana into the referee. Santana then hits the flying forearm. General Adnan comes in, attacking Santana with the Iraq flag. And Slaughter applies the camel clutch. And the referee taps Slaughter on the shoulder. And Slaughter's celebrating, thinking that he won. And then Howard Finkel with the delivery of the night. Sergeant Slaughter has been disqualified, and everyone cheers, and Slaughter loses his mind at the 10-minute, 47-second mark, and Monsoon says,
no. Look at Slaughter, has he been out of shape or what? You should hide your head in shame.
Isn't that the way the Iraqi women walk around?
You got it.
And Monsoon says, you got it. Holy shit. WWF with real world issues being tackled on their broadcasts.
Yeah, that's a little.
Wow.
That's a bit much.
This match sucked.
Yeah, they
in
really.
In every way.
They tried to build a story here with Slaughter being the only person on his team against the four of them, but the crowd really didn't react to many of the falls. And I think that's perhaps because the wrestling wasn't as good. Perhaps the baby faces here weren't as strong as they were in the previous matches. It just wasn't much of a thing. And if you're building Slaughter,
he shouldn't have been losing on this show, but you had to. He either loses here or he loses to Hogan or Warrior, which is what you're building up to at the Rumble with Warrior and Hogan at WrestleMania. So there was no reason. And I'm sorry, all these examples we're throwing out, I don't get this grand finale match at all. Other than it was to fill time on what was already a pretty short show. But thankfully, we had segments like this to stretch things out a bit. First of all, we had Sean Mooney with the heel survivors, DiBiase, Martel, Power and Glory, and the Warlord. And DiBiase says that Santana is at the right place at the wrong time, and then cites WrestleMania 6 and why there's going to be dissension between the Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan. Mm-hmm. Ted DiBiase, maybe the underappreciated MVP of this show.
Yep.
Promos were great, good stuff with Brett in the match, and carried the main event as a top heel that could go and be in both matches. Ted DiBiase was great on this show, I thought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how long was his association with The Undertaker following this?
It was brief. It was really just coming out of this, they would eventually transition over to Paul Bearer. It was just a matter of weeks that they really had that connection.
So I wonder really why. I mean, I suppose it was just simply the timing on this pay-per-view that you know, he had that slot. But, you know, being the great talker, the great character that he was, I suppose that kind of gave him some of the reason why they felt comfortable introducing the character with him.
Yeah, I mean, instantly establish him as a heel. That was the match to do it in. Dusty was kind of winding down with the company, and that was a big win to give The Undertaker. And he'd have, I believe, another one on TV that had already been taped over Dusty. So they kind of used Dusty to get Taker over in the immediate introduction of the character. And then Okerlund is with the egg. And he was just going to have fun with this segment. He said, "Oh, this cracks me up." And talks about all the speculation about what could be in the egg. Would it be a dinosaur? A rabbit? Balloons? Think of that payoff. God. Or the Playmate of the Month, which got one of the biggest reactions on the show.
Wow.
Yeah. A naked woman.
I don't even think they do Playmates anymore.
No, they're done with their...
nudity.
Yeah, they got rid of nudity. And then says... "I think that egg is ready to blow." And just like that, the egg cracks and out comes the now famous gobbledygooker and the boos that came from this Hartford crowd. And that was it wasn't even like ripping a Band-Aid off, like, let's just get through this. Then we had this painful, painful segment that went on for hours, it seemed. Okerlund has to have a conversation with this non-coherent gobbledygooker. Then they went and danced in the ring. They rolled around in the ring. And Monsoon probably said it best, stating that some things just don't fly, Hot Rod. And just kept going on and on. Monsoon and Piper just had nothing to say. And this character, they just found random ways to integrate him into television for the next couple of weeks, popping up during interview segments with guys like Coco Beware and others. And it was just, I don't know what they were thinking, if they were thinking. But this was the trivia note being Hector Guerrero's contributions to Survivor Series history.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell I was watching here. It felt like it was some excuse to fill time, I assume, on the show. It went on forever. It looked ridiculous. Where is this costume today, I wonder?
Probably in the WWF warehouse.
I'm surprised we don't see it at Access every year. What were future appearances by the gobbledygooker?
I think they were very sporadic.
Wasn't he at the WrestleMania 17?
He was in the gimmick battle royal.
Yeah.
That's right.
Who played him that time, you know?
I actually don't know. Hmm. I don't know if it was Hector or if it was somebody else. Someone let us know.
It is...
pressing questions.
Yeah, things like this. Just even a simple appearance like this has... I mean, people still talk about it to this.
Oh, it lives on in infamy. Yeah. I mean, that for sure can be said. Like, just an ultimate bomb in history. And again, you go to surprises. You better have something good if you're going to tease a surprise, because there's no limit to what people are going to expect. I mean, they thought maybe someone's coming over from WCW.
Out of an egg.
Well, there you
go. Yeah.
Like, just, I don't even know.
It'd be Ric Flair.
Like, how does this even... How does a plan like this even begin to hatch? like, let's have an egg. Do we have a reason for it? No, we just want an egg. Yeah. And it's going to crack. It's just like we have nothing. There's nothing to this.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just thankfully it wasn't wasted on someone of importance. I mean, yeah. That's the saving grace in this whole thing. This would have ruined someone's career. This could have been the reintroduction of the Red Rooster.
It kind of would have made sense. Actually, that should have been the feud.
Logical, yeah.
Yeah.
The rooster and the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the gobbledygooker. And then Mooney is with Warrior, Hogan, and Santana. And Hogan referred to Sean Mooney as Little Dude. And then says, "Me and the Ariba Man have been around since day one." The Ariba Man. Mm-hmm. What was most... hilarious about all this was Santana trying to hang with Hogan and Warrior on promos, and gave like this big like 80s brother kind of promo, and just did not fit. Utter insanity from the Ultimate Warrior. And then they posed like maniacs to end this segment, with Hogan looking like he was just getting electrocuted under the belt or something.
Warrior here starts to cut his promo with his back completely turned to the camera, and there's just one point where you could tell Santana was just like patting him on the back to tell him to turn. And this is your WWF champion at the time.
He was not one for blocking. Yeah. But there was no wrist tape involved in this one.
No. I almost wish there was.
No. Ultimate Warrior, Hulk Hogan, and Tito Santana taking on Ted DiBiase, Rick Martel, Paul Roma, Hercules, and the Warlord in the grand finale match of Survivors.
5-on-3?
5-on-3 for the heels. At least they got that right. A fan nearly ripped off Paul Roma's shirt on his way to the ring, and he turned and looked like he was ready to clock this guy for almost ripping off his belly button t-shirt that barely covered his chest. Santana immediately pins Warlord with a flying forearm. This might have been faster than Boris Zukov was eliminated.
Again, you know, I suppose they were short on time, but...
And that was the other thing. You had, like, 5 eliminations here in, like, 9 minutes this match went.
Like, was there really a point?
No. There was no point to any of this.
For Warlord to be in the match for, you know... They didn't even play with the disadvantage that much. So it was this match was just very quick with a lot of very unrealistic eliminations.
Maybe Gobbledygooker went over his time and they had to cut this.
Oh, they must have.
Warlord was the unofficial victim of the Gobbledygooker debut.
That's the other thing. It seemed like the whole Gooker thing was all done for time fill. Yet in this, we had to race.
9 minutes this went. So Warlord's out. Then Roma hit a power slam to Santana. He misses a flying forearm to DiBiase, gets guillotined on the top rope. DiBiase eliminates Santana. They got the heat on Hogan, frequent tags in the heel corner, taking turns. Hogan started his comeback, clotheslined Roma, and eliminates him. And once again, Piper says, life continues. He was not one to dwell on an elimination in a traditional Survivor Series setting. Warrior gets tagged in with Martel, no selling everything. Body slams him. Hogan comes in, lands the boot, shitty clothesline that sends Martel through the ropes, and Rick Martel, also a favored member of the heel locker room, gets counted out and called a chicken and a coward by Piper and Monsoon as he's gone. DiBiase, selling big for Hogan, takes a big boot and a leg drop. Out goes DiBiase, and then a body slam to Hercules. Warrior comes in, clothesline, flying shoulder block, splash, and Warrior, who is the WWF champion at the time, pins Hercules, and then they double-team Slick, toss him to the floor. God knows why. They're just bullies. And then the post-match celebration consisted of Warrior whipping his title over his head and then each guy holding the ropes open like gentlemen for the other to exit to the floor. And then this very weird-looking low-angle shot of two gassed-up monsters posing on the apron like they're these Greek gods, and Monsoon proclaiming that they are the new breed of professional athletes in the world today. Not untrue, but not a positive sign of the times.
It was positive. That was.
Well said.
Anyway, so, you know, I suppose if you're a fan of these two, if you're a fan at the time, it was kind of cool probably to see Hogan and Warrior teaming up together in this final scene. In the end, it felt like a fun house show. Rather than something that carried any big storyline consequences going forward.
Survivor Series was kind of closer to that. I mean, you got some little storyline stuff, but it was largely a novelty show where you get to see names teaming up with guys they never do. It's still something unique to see stars versus stars. And it's a concept that the company definitely outgrew. And it's not viable today.
Although last year's match, I thought, you know, branched off into some great storytelling points.
Yeah, they built it up. I think there's certainly, if you grew up with it, there's definitely the nostalgia factor of the traditional Survivor Series. I think the idea, though, of seeing these names against these names, you get that. Multiple hours every single week. And I'm not opposed to one, but a pay-per-view of these matches, there's a reason they don't do them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, like I said, I think if you grew up with these characters and grew up with this show, perhaps I think you might have really enjoyed this just to see Hogan and everybody in sort of in their heyday, but that wasn't really for me, and so I kind of felt the show was pretty boring and tough to watch at times.
What'd you give this show?
I give it a 4.5 out of 10.
And who does the Putski Award go to? This is one we have to give.
That one's tough. I mean, for me, the candidates are Hercules, Warlord.
Roma,
sure.
Snuka?
Snuka.
Snuka, maybe just because of the age factor.
Yeah. So what? Who do you give it to?
I'll nominate Snuka.
Let's give it to Snuka. Congratulations. What do you rate?
I give this show a 5 out. I'll say 5 out of 10. I really thought the debut of The Undertaker was well done. I thought that match was really well put together and achieved a lot of things. But I think this show, I think it really relies on your nostalgia as a child watching this show. I can see it holding a big place in your heart. I have a very black heart, and I don't tend to value nostalgia all that much. But there are people that love this show, as we're going to see in the feedback here. But I'm with you, Wade. It wasn't a show that really did a ton for me, all in all. And I was – even growing up, I was never a big fan of the Survivor Series. It wasn't – like the Royal Rumble, I always looked forward to that. I like the King of the Ring. I like the one-night tournament idea. Survivor Series, to me, it was just – trying to cram a lot into a certain amount of time where you had to race through eliminations. I think if anything, it somewhat took away from the star power of some guys because you had to do so many of these eliminations in quick fashion, and it could tell a nice story, but at the same time, it was never something that I really can say I was that much into when it was in its heyday.
Are you for retaining the at least the name of the pay-per-view? Sure.
Yes, I think it still does have value. One of the ideas I really liked that Agnew had years ago when they did the first old school Raw was the idea of trying that at the Survivor Series, in that you do your matches, but you make it like the graphics, the promos, like you make it like this nostalgia feel, because that's what the Survivor Series is sold on, nostalgia, because people remember the Survivor Series, and make it your one show of the year that you're still doing all your current stories and matches, but it's presented like old school Raw is once a year.
Hmm.
And I think there's certainly value to the name of it, and I wouldn't be changing the name of it, but they're far past the point where you can just load up on traditional Survivor Series matches and that's all you put on the show. That's why they ended up adding championship matches to Survivor Series. It wasn't enough to sell people on tag matches. Mm. So we start off on the message board with Matt in Detroit. Without drifting too far into nostalgia, Survivor Series may be the best pay-per-view with an all-inclusive story. 10 visionaries out of 10. While I first saw this as a 6-year-old, I thought the WWF made the move that could have kept this pay-per-view right next to the Rumble as the best pay-per-view of any year. And I don't mean because of the gobbledygooker. The main event, winner-take-all, sole survivor match, was a brilliant concept. Best match was the visionaries blinding the Vipers for the first whole team to ever survive.
We go to Christian Small, who says, when you open the show with Vince McMahon running through the matches in his typical 90s way, you know you have a good show. I really like the show. It was one of the first VHS videos I ever got as a fan, so I must have watched it hundreds of times. Rewatching this show now, you can see that they were really protective of their heels. Mr. Perfect was a bumping machine who came back from a 2-on-1 against both the WWF and IC champs. The Undertaker killed everyone in his debut and was counted out. The whole Visionaries team survived. Recap. Of course, that didn't really stick in the grand finale match, but that was the right move in my view. I also believe this was probably Coco Beware's most famous WWE moment, just being destroyed by the debuting Undertaker. I honestly can't think of anything else he did of note in the WWE.
Coco had his moments. I mean, high energy that he would go on to team with Owen Hart. He had his, Coco Beware. WWE Hall of Famer. Yeah. Dwayne from Ireland. First time I've watched this show, but it made me remember just how awesome elimination tag matches can be as a concept. I don't understand why WWE always just have one traditional elimination match on these shows nowadays. It's a perfect way to progress a number of angles without giving away the big singles match. There was one thing that really infuriated me, though, and that was Hulk Hogan. At the end of his first match, he took a banner that a fan had obviously put a lot of work into and posed with it for a few seconds before wiping off his sweat with it and then tossed it back to the fan. What an asshole. 8 out of 10.
All right, we go to McWhalen, who has an angry me review. I was hoping nostalgia would get me through Survivor Series 1990, but I guess I was wrong. As much as I liked the final Survivor showdown idea, this show sucked. The Undertaker debuted, and WrestleCrap was born with the gobbledygooker hatching out of the egg. It didn't bother me. It didn't matter if it was the Undertaker or a nude Playboy playmate, because no one was getting over after getting out of that egg. The rest of the matches sucked, and Hogan and Warrior stood tall after beating over 10 guys to end the show. This may be one of the weaker Survivor Series ever. The best moments were Taker debuting, Bret DiBiase, and the Gooker flatlining on a live pay-per-view.
I love it. Dissension from people. Ronaldo from Italy. A lot of people pretty much consider the early Survivor Series pay-per-views nothing but filler with little to no storyline advancement. As a 10-year-old back in the day, it was the exact opposite for me. I loved the bright colors, the big guys, the heroes and villains, and of course, Warrior teaming up with Hogan in the final match made this a can't-miss show for me. The Undertaker was treated as the new giant in town and protected well in his debut. The gobbledygooker is vintage crap, which makes it gold, and pretty much innocent stuff that didn't ruin anyone's ongoing angle. At the top of the list of the great pay-per-views from the 1990s. Wish WWE still had a roster this deep.
We got Dallas from Surrey, which is the proud home of Earthquake. I'll never forget the first time I watched this show. Last day of school before Christmas vacation in 1990, and I called my dad to come pick me up as I was sick. We stopped on the way home to rent the show and had to get it on beta as the VHS copies had all been rented. As for the actual show, I love it for all the nostalgia and great memories I have of this era. Watching it now, the only thing that really stood out to me, it seems like it was the real beginning of the Bret Hart singles push with his showing. Finally, I've heard that they were planning on doing the Hogan Warrior rematch at WrestleMania 7. Was that still the plan at this point? To me, it seemed odd to see the both of them standing in the ring at the end, considering the direction the story went.
That was certainly an idea coming out of WrestleMania 6, was that they would go to the rematch between the two a year later. However, by this point, they already knew that, I mean, Slaughter was brought in with the idea of going all the way with this guy, and it was already set that Warrior would be dropping the title to Slaughter at the Rumble, and then Warrior would be going off with Savage, and it would be Hogan and Slaughter at WrestleMania. It was a classic Vince McMahon kind of character in Sergeant Slaughter, something that was going to upset people, that was hopefully going to get some heat, and just go all the way with the guy. So by this point, they weren't planning on going the Hogan Warrior route for WrestleMania. Jesse from the Six, splendorous choice for a review this week. I forgot the Taker was and is a ginger. It was peculiar having the WWE champion in the opener. I think the Warriors versus the Perfect Team should have been the penultimate match. I treasure watching early Bret and Shawn work. My two highlights of the show were Bret's chest-first turnbuckle bump and Shawn being back body dropped into the ionosphere by the Warlord. Speaking of the Warlord, there are many worthy Putski candidates on this show, but I think that belt must rest on the bulging mutant shoulders of the Warlord. For F's sake, he looked like Zangief from Street Fighter here. That's true. Warlord would be up there, I would say, of all time. And two questions. Why wasn't Piper wrestling at this point? Loved Hot Rod, but he was not a great commentator. Piper was just largely segueing away from wrestling at this point. This was before he had that motorcycle accident in 1991 and was primarily just a commentator at this point. So that was just their own decision. He was also involved more in movies at this point in time, and wrestling wasn't his full focus. And why was the DiBiase Warrior title match scheduled for main event the following night? Was Vince just dead set against singles matches at Survivor Series at this point? There was a singles title match in 91, so it seemed odd to me. It was just that, the Survivor Series traditional matches, that was the draw at that particular time in 1990. They did flip over in 91, I think, sensing that they needed to put a different focus on top of their Survivor Series matches. But then they would go back in other years, like 93, for instance, and it was all traditional matches. The question there, that was the match they had taped for main event, and that was just their philosophy at the time of Survivor Series. And I don't know how well a Warrior-DiBiase match truly would have done on pay-per-view, to be quite honest.
We go to Ludovic from France. When it comes to this show, God, I really disliked it. First of all, I always hated Hogan and his way to put himself over, even when he was next to the world champion, which in my opinion should never happen. Warrior was the champ, but still it was Hogan who was the main focus. Some of the pinfalls were laughable. Some guys were forced to sell some of the shittiest offense I've ever seen, like they were shot in the head. Hopefully some decent workers made some parts of it watchable for me. HBK and Jannetty, Bret Hart, Mr. Perfect, and Rick Martel. That reminded me of his awesome vignettes for Arrogance. And then he says, and how can I not talk about possibly the worst thing ever to happen in professional wrestling, the gobbledygooker. This was just painful and embarrassing to watch. I felt ashamed to be a wrestling fan. From the music, to the interview, to the dance, everything sucked about this segment, and the lucha moves from the turkey monster wrestler made me laugh, knowing that Hector Guerrero was under that monstrous costume. Far, far worse than the Shockmaster.
All right, next up is... we've got Bear... from Scotland. Hi guys, long time listener. I was 8 when this event happened, and having just gotten into wrestling at the previous SummerSlam, I was eager to take in as much WWF as possible. The 8-year-old me loved this show, and it was interesting to see which wrestlers were friends and would team together. Having rewatched it recently, a couple of things stand out. Mr. Perfect was excellent, making the faces look great with his over-the-top selling. Undertaker with an impressive debut and unjustly counted out, but Bret Hart was the standout here for me with a performance that showed he was a future star. One thing that bothered me back then, and I still noticed on viewing now, was how Gorilla Monsoon immediately calls the Tombstone as Taker hits it on Coco. Wait, Gorilla, 5 minutes ago you had never seen this man before, and already you know the name of his finishing maneuver. The Vipers team looked good on paper, but were made to look like glorified jobbers against a team that essentially were just that. Shawn Michaels pinned by Paul Roma, a guy that would later hit his finisher on Hogan, then be immediately pinned by a clothesline. Amazingly, Earthquake was only 27 here. The only guy younger than that on the current roster is Bo Dallas. I guess they had it harder in those days. Poor Earthquake must have had quite the paper round. 6 out of 10 from me, and that is down to Perfect and Brett. Love the reviews. Keep up the great work.
Is that true? There's nobody old, besides Bo Dallas, that's older than 27.
On the main roster, I don't think that's...
What about the women?
The women are definitely young. I mean, Sasha Banks is 23. I mean, I don't know all ages off the top of my head, but I would... I don't know.
We got an Andrew who says, I really like the show. I like the concept of a number of Team Survivor Series matches, and I wish the WWE would do it more often. The Undertaker's debut was great, and they should consider debuting someone in a similar fashion at the Survivor Series. My biggest problem with it was Roddy Piper's commentary. I didn't mind him throughout the show, but it went into Roddy Piper promo mode, making fun and ridiculing The Undertaker at times. I thought Piper flipped the switch completely when Bret was the final person in the match, and he was putting Bret and the match over as if it were the main event of WrestleMania. Anyway, the concept is great. You can create angles coming out of it. The matches are fun, and I wish there were more of them. 7 out of 10.
And the final piece of feedback comes from Steve Kassan. I really do not understand why WWE does not stay with this format or gimmick as a one-night-only special event. It is what made this pay-per-view very unique. Set in Thanksgiving, the team-on-team format, with this episode you had special names such as the Visionaries versus the Vipers, etc. In today's landscape, when you have an event month after month plus NXT specials, a special gimmick event such as the Survivor Series does change things up quite a bit. Also, you have the ability to create superstars or validate someone, as this is our guy. It worked 2 weeks ago on Raw. It surely helped Reigns. This is the end of my mini rant. As for this show, the biggest takeaway is the debut of The Undertaker. It's amazing how a character as this has survived for 25 years, or 22 if you take out his years as the American Badass. Piper's commentary is both hit and miss. The Gooker I will not comment, as it would be a focal point of the review. The wrestling was fine, and this show is a nice look back at the WWE's early days. It's amazing how Hogan still had the spotlight even though Warrior was the champion. I know it's general feedback about the show, but my main thing is, why doesn't WWE keep this specialty event? I know they listen after they take all of your ideas for Raw, right? Well, I think I've outlined it. I think that the Survivor Series, I think there's certain nostalgia you can play off of from the Survivor Series, but in terms of the actual format, I mean, there's been years over the past where they do put the traditional Survivor Series matches in there, and I don't think it has the same kind of lasting impact. I mean, Survivor Series is not a show that when they were still pre-network, it's not like it's a show that just drew on its own because of the concept and putting a few elimination matches on there. You're so spoiled now because every Raw, every SmackDown, you're seeing name versus name, and you're seeing guys team up, and it's not special to the degree it would have been in 1990, and that's just a matter of adapting to changing times. It's not going to be the same reaction to something 25 years ago as it is today. It doesn't stun me that this isn't a concept that is as viable today as it once was.
I think it's still a great idea for a TV show, for something that's building up to a championship match. And I wouldn't discount it completely, you know, for members of the undercard. But it definitely feels like they get more value out of a champion headlining a show rather than one of these.
I think you also have to have a clear direction. If you're doing one of these matches, if there's one guy that you're trying to break through to the next level, he's going to get a key elimination. I mean, I go back a few years ago to 2010 when they had Kofi Kingston pin Randy Orton, and it was a huge deal for him at the time. And they had it in mind that we're going to get Kofi over. He's going to pin someone that it's a big deal to beat this guy. I think if you have that, the match can be used to its effectiveness. But if it's just for the sake of doing it, and we're just going to have a winner at the end of this, and it doesn't matter a whole lot who's beating who, I think there's a lot to be desired in that case. So we're going to wrap things up. We will close off the show with our interview with Paul Bearer because we forgot to throw to it after the review. But first, let's go to the poll and see what people have to say. Wei, isn't this exciting?
Yes.
This is more exciting to me than the recent federal election here in Canada.
Okay.
We asked people which AWA-themed show you would like us to review, be it the WWE's AWA documentary or Super Clash 85. And of the 96 votes to come in over the course of this show, 61% of you want to hear us review AWA Super Clash 1985.
Nice.
Are you excited, Wei?
I am. What
big
is on
review?
What's on the show?
Well, Mr. Ting, it is going to feature in the main event for the AWA Heavyweight Championship, Rick Martel and Stan Hansen. We're going to see Kerry Von Erich in action. The recently retired Junichiro Tenryu, Harley Race, Nick Bockwinkel, Ray Stevens, Sherry Martel, Ric Flair against Magnum TA, Kamala. This is a pretty stacked 13-match card, Wei.
Wow.
So you can watch this entire show on YouTube if you search for AWA Super Clash 85 from Chicago, Illinois at Comiskey Park from September of 1985. So that will be our review next week. Lots to talk about. Our first AWA-themed review. So fitting with the recent passing of Nick Bockwinkel. So that'll be our chat coming up next week. So in the meantime, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. This coming Sunday night on The Law at midnight Eastern time, it's myself and Dan the Mouth Lavransky. We're running through the Survivor Series from top to bottom. And it's bigger than Brock Lesnar coming for a limited date. It's bigger than The Rock showing up. Wei Ting will be in the TSN studios. He will be ready to chat. And he's going to pipe in with his thoughts on the Survivor Series.
Oh, am I?
It's a rare night where Wei Ting is going to come and watch the event and then stick around for the show afterwards.
Yes, I will be there. I will be there taking your phone calls, call screening.
It's a traditional Law elimination style show.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know what's being eliminated, but we know what we are adding.
Jason Agnew is being
eliminated. They are away. Him and Braden are away this week. So tune in on Sunday night for the biggest return in Law history.
Probably hatching out of an egg.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. Okay, so here it is. Paul Bearer, who was on The Law in April of 2010. To put this into context, this was just after WrestleMania 26 when The Undertaker beat Shawn Michaels for the second time at WrestleMania, which was Shawn Michaels' retirement match. And we talked with Paul Bearer about his entire career in the WWE and the connection that he is most famous for with The Undertaker. And we'll speak with you next time on Review Away.
We just thought it would be great to have you on the show because WrestleMania last weekend and Taker was involved in the huge match with Shawn Michaels. And you worked with Mark Calloway for so long. In fact, the two of you actually worked together in, was it Texas before the WWF?
Yeah, I was his first manager in his first match in the business at the Sportatorium out in Dallas. And I think that was about 1986. Seven maybe, and so we had a little history there.
Did you?
Before we were put together, in WWE.
Did you think even from those early days that he would become the star that he did? Could you see it right from the start, or was he kind of the diamond in the rough back then?
Oh, absolutely not. It was a complete diamond in the rough. No, we didn't have a clue. No clue at all.
Can you, I guess, explain for the listeners, for the fans, how it did all come together? How did Paul Bearer and Undertaker become that great force back in, like, well, I guess it was back in the early 90s?
Well, it was the wrestling in Dallas, World Class Championship Wrestling, was closing down at the time. And we're talking about, it was December of 1990, and I was going to leave and move back home to my home in Mobile, Alabama. And a lot of people don't know I'm a legit mortician.
Right.
I have a degree in mortuary science, and it's always been wrestling and funeral service for me ever since I was a kid. Well, anyway, long story short, I was getting ready to leave Dallas, so I'd been there 6 years, and moved back home to Alabama. And I happened to speak to one of my good buddies, Rick Rude, at the time, and Rick Rude told me, he says, no, don't do that. He said, you just hang on, and I'll call you back. Don't do anything drastic until I call you back. So it was about the same day, the same afternoon, he called me back, says, you got a pencil and paper? Yeah. He said, write this name and number down, which I did, and it was Vince McMahon's phone number. He wanted me to call Vince, and I called Vince. We talked briefly. He set me up a flight, flew up to Stanford at the old Titan Towers there, and had a meeting with him there. And it was pretty weird because at the time Vince didn't know about my history in funeral service.
Right.
Vince didn't know that I have a degree in mortuary science. He was aware, of course, of my background in the wrestling business, because I'd already been in the business 15 years at that time.
Right.
And I didn't know that Vince was looking for a manager for The Undertaker. So it was kind of weird when we finally came to the, you know, when we talked and he realized that I was a mortician and I realized he was looking for a manager for The Undertaker. It was just a match made in heaven.
It was meant to be.
It was just meant to be, and it happened, and the chemistry was just there, and I was just blessed.
Yeah, I mean, what was going through your mind when this guy approaches you to play basically a mortician? I mean, you must have just thought, wow, the gods are smiling down at me. I mean, what better person to do the job?
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I left that meeting, I'll never forget the day, it was December 22nd, 1990, and the reason I remember the exact date is because that was me and my wife's wedding anniversary, was December 22nd, so I won't forget the date. but when I left there and after the meeting, I came home with a contract in hand, I was still living in Dallas, I arrived back home in Dallas with a contract in hand, but I didn't know at that time, still that, you know, about the Paul Bearer character, and that's what I was going to be doing. About two weeks later, J.J. Dillon called me and kind of went over briefly, you know, what they wanted me to do and about wanted me to color my hair and this, that, and the other, wear the black suit, and I was going to be managing The Undertaker. And I wasn't. Yeah, I was really excited about, you know, getting the bump up to WWE or WWF back in those days.
Right.
But, my God, talking about two different ends of the spectrum, being the blonde-haired, bleached blonde Percy Pringle for all those years.
Right, yeah, because that the Percy Pringle character was kind of your arrogant rich guy kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and you know, the was the blonde hair,
yeah,
and everything, and then going from that to the black hair, black suits, pasty white. Oh yes, you know, what two different ends of the spectrum.
It is,
and it was, you know, it was pretty difficult transition there at first, but like I tell a lot of people, you know, once I got that first check, it was all downhill. It was all downhill from there.
Well, how did you make the transition, and how did you make Paul Bearer so unique? Like the interview style that you used, and like where did all that stuff come from? Where did you draw?
Back in those days, you know, there wasn't any scripted interviews or anything like that, like they do today. Like I said, I'd been in the business 15 years at that point, and Vince had a lot of confidence, you know, in myself and Mark himself. And pretty much all that stuff in the early days just was off the cuff. It was just things that, you know, just kind of happened. I use the word a thousand times, during, you know, when I talk about things like this. It was a blessing. It was just meant to be. The chemistry was there. I'd known Mark, you know, a few years prior to that time, and so we knew each other, and it was just meant to be. It was just a perfect recipe, thank God, you know.
It
people
was.
Find it hard to believe, but it was just there.
It was. No, it absolutely was. And, you know, after years and years of doing that voice, did you ever have any issues with your throat? I mean, I would try to imitate you for, like, a couple of minutes, and my throat would be sore. Was that a tough one on your voice?
And that was another thing. Nobody ever told me, you know, Vince never, or anybody, any of the creative staff at that time, nobody ever told me that, you know, that's what you wanted me to do, or anything. It just happened. You'd watch the old horror movies with Boris Karloff, you know,
right.
and I started doing the, and I didn't do the voice right away.
It kind of
developed over a period of time. When I started doing the segments they had, they called the funeral parlor. That was
right.
A segment that I had.
Yep.
And it just happened. It just happened.
It was amazing.
It was just a blessing.
There's no doubt that in those early days of the Undertaker's character, there's no way it would have gotten over as strongly as it did without you doing the promos. I mean, you were such an essential part of those early days of the Undertaker.
Well, I appreciate that, and we certainly had a damn good time.
If you had to sit back and pick some of your favorite moments working or favorite angles with Taker, what would have some of them been? What ones really did you enjoy?
Man, they were all good. They really were. We had a long run, you know, with the Ultimate Warrior there for a while early on. Where we locked him in a casket, you know, we're in an airtight casket, he couldn't breathe, and they used sledgehammers and drills and busted him out to save his life, and then he wasn't breathing, they had to do CPR to bring him back, and then, you know, and we carried that all around the world. We done body bags matches with him, casket matches with him, and it was just natural.
Did you guys have trouble working with him? Because he's always been portrayed as a somewhat temperamental kind of guy, the Ultimate Warrior.
I didn't. Mark certainly did. But I never had to wrestle him.
Right.
But I had a history with him, too, because I managed him early on in his career when he started out in Dallas, too. Back during that time, he was the Dingo Warrior.
Right, right.
And I managed him back then, and we knew each other, and I never had a problem with him, you know, never ever once had a problem with him. But Mark had many sleepless nights.
Was that because he didn't enjoy working with him in the ring, or?
Well, it was just Jim. That was just the way he was, and he was kind of hard-headed a little bit, I guess, and he liked to do things his way,
yeah.
You know, and But eventually, you know, as we went around, like I said, we worked with each other so many times and so many different matches and gimmicks that things came around there too, and they eventually had a meeting of the minds, and things went well, and it turned out to be a great angle, which we had. We worked with so many guys, you know, like Yokozuna and Kamala and Jack Roberts, and just I can just go on and on and on.
What? How did you feel about the addition of the Kane character when we had kind of the whole dynamic of, you know, what it changed quite a bit. I mean, brothers, and you were the father, and all that kind of stuff. How did you feel about the addition of Kane?
Well, that was something that me and Mark, you know, kind of came up with ourselves. You know, during our travels, you know, of course we talk, you know, and we were trying to think of something that we could add to kind of spice it up a little bit. And me and Mark came up with the idea of the brother, you know, and the name and everything. We didn't have a clue who it was going to be. It was
right.
Just something we would toss around, you know, on the road, and off times in airports and while we were driving around. And then just by chance, we went to Smoky Mountain Wrestling, you know, for Jim Cornette to do a few shows for him. And there we met Glenn Jacobs, who was the Unabomber at that time.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and Mark had a couple of matches with him up in Smoky Mountain, and there it was again. The chemistry was just there. We just hit it off. He was a great guy. And when we went back, you know, to Stanford, it kind of, we took his name with us. And they started using him out, you know, using him and some of the crazy stuff. You know, he was the dentist. Jerry Lawler's dentist, you know.
Yeah, Isaac Yankum,
you know.
Right.
And then he had played a couple other things where he was the fake Diesel, I guess.
Right.
And then it just it fell right into the place with the Kane scenario, and it just worked.
Yep, never looked back.
You know, I mean, sometimes when I tell any stories, I you know, I make it sound like it was easy, like it and. It's and you know I make it sound like it is easier than what it was. It was certainly you know a lot of work, but it was there. The chemistry was there. It's like making a cake. All the recipe, all the ingredients were just there, and we put them in a pot, stirred them up, and stuck in the oven, and it worked.
It did.
Thank God. Thank God it worked. Oh yes.
excuse me. Bill, I have to ask, what do you think has been the one, like, why has the Undertaker's gimmick lasted so long, endeared for so long? I mean, he's from another era, yet he's still considered one of the top guys here in 2010. What is it about the Taker gimmick that it keeps people coming back?
I think the basic of it all is Mark himself, the type of person he is. The tremendous athlete he is and the tremendous gentleman and businessman that he is. And all through the years, you know, he continuously changed. And that certainly added to his longevity. You know, he became the American Badass there
right.
for the while and just changed, you know, his look and all that added to it. Gosh, it's just hard to believe. It's been so many. The years have just went. Whew.
It's true.
You know, here we
it's
are, at almost 20
yeah.
years.
Yeah, yeah.
20 years ago, like you had asked me earlier, did we have a clue how long it was going to last, or what was going to happen? 20 years.
Yeah.
My God. I mean, nobody can touch that.
That's absolutely very impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, did you get to see the match with Shawn and Undertaker at WrestleMania last weekend?
Oh yes. Oh, absolutely.
And
for sure,
it was a great match. I mean, I thought the two of them, it was just as good as their match the year before. When it comes to retirements in wrestling, they're always a little dicey, for sure. Do you think Shawn Michaels will stay retired?
Well, you know, with the history of retirements in our business, you know, it just doesn't usually happen. You know, you'll see a guy, look at Ric Flair, for example. I'm not talking bad about Rick at all, because I've been a Flair fan for years and years, and I still am.
Right.
But gosh, look how long his retirement outlasted.
I know, not very long.
But I think Sean, you know, will be away for a long, long time, but I would certainly never say never, because sooner or later there's always that an idea that pops up that would bring somebody back. And I wish him all the best. He certainly needs the time off. He certainly needs the rest. He certainly deserves it. But it's, I would not be surprised if he didn't pop up again, you know, a year or two down the road. It's just the nature of the beast when it comes to our business.
It's very true. It definitely seems to be hard to stay away. On the other side of the coin, we have the Undertaker streak. I mean, it means more in wrestling today than any world title means, or like it's the one concrete kind of thing, it seems, in pro wrestling, because everybody just doesn't care about titles anymore.
No.
Do you think the streak will ever be broken, or should it ever be broken?
Well, I don't know. At this point, if I was certainly on the creative team or anything, and I don't have any insight at all when Mark's going to be ready to retire, I don't think it's going to be any time soon.
Right.
Because we're still dear friends, and we still communicate. He still enjoys the business, because it's the kind of business that if you don't enjoy it, you just can't do it.
Sure.
You you got to have fun, and you know, if it ain't fun, I don't want to do it. And he's kind of the same way. He still enjoys, you know, having fun. But after all these years and all the injuries, and he's had some major problems with his hips, you know, over the last year or so. And I don't see him retiring, you know, anytime soon. But you know, Mark, but when he decides to go, it's going to be his time. But I don't, you know, as far as the streak. Why ruin a good thing?
Sure.
Why?
Sure. No, absolutely. Did you ever think there'd be one more time when Paul Bearer might get a chance to accompany Taker to the ring?
Well, like I said a second ago, never say never. I would never say that it will never happen. And if the time's right, the opportunity's right, and everything's right, you just don't ever know. You know, it's. Because that part piece of the puzzle is certainly still there.
It's you never can tell with professional wrestling.
No,
that's for
no,
sure.
And I won't say that it won't happen, because you just don't ever know.